This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Thanks so much for joining us. We have a great show lined up today. I'm Steve Thompson, Tom Schroyer, host of our program. Good to see you, Tom.
Great to see you too, Steve. We're excited here again today to have Kristen Huebner back. Kristen is a lawyer at Moss and Barnett who focuses her practice on litigation and trial work. And Kristen, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me back.
This is, I believe, your third time on the program.
It is. It is. And I have a number of clients, friends, and family listening today, so I want to thank them and all the listeners. I think we're going to have a great show today, and hopefully people will learn something. So thanks.
Oh, absolutely. And so, Steve, Kristen was, again, this year recognized as a rising star by Minnesota Law and Politics, and that's been confirmed by her appointment to the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, where Kristen is now the vice president and just starting a term. How long will that run for, Kristen?
That term of vice president will run for the next calendar year.
And so you've been on the Board of Dentistry regulating licensing for dentists in Minnesota now for several years.
I have. I started in 2007. I was appointed by Governor Plenty at that time, and my term expires in the spring of 2011.
Oh, very good. And I know that has also led to some national exposure. You were just a speaker on a national panel in Las Vegas on the Association of Regulatory Boards. Tell us a little bit about what that is concerning.
It's called FARB. It's the Federal Association of Regulatory Boards. And what it is a group of individuals who serve on boards that regulate licensed professionals all over the country who come and meet, talk about regulatory issues. And I was asked to speak on a three-member panel of board members to talk about policymaking, what kinds of legal issues affect boards nationwide.
And I guess that kind of an event is an exception to the rule that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
This is true.
All right. And so our topic today is Lawsuits 101. This sounds a little bit like such an overarching topic that it's going to be hard to get through, but we're going to focus on some specific points, and it's really kind of an exciting program, for me anyway, because I think people get used to seeing, of course, what happens at the end of the process in the trial, maybe the closing argument, but they really don't see all of the work and effort and the time that go into preparing for that moment.
That's true, Tom. And so what we're going to talk about today is just kind of the basic steps in the litigation process for civil lawsuits. So once the complaint is prepared and filed in court or served on the other side, there's a whole litany of things that happen until the trial happens later on. And we're going to talk about what those different steps entail, what the parties are doing, what the lawyers are doing behind the scenes, and hopefully answer some questions today.
Oh, that's going to be really interesting. And, of course, most people don't realize, I think, that a trial lawyer like yourself, Kristen, really serves wears so many different hats in helping to get a trial ready to go from start to finish. You're the producer, the writer, the director, and also you're the lead actor at the closing. And certainly that's a lot to do.
That's true. What you're really doing when you're taking a case from start to finish through trial is you're telling your client's story. You're helping your client tell their story in the best way possible. You're trying to resolve their legal dispute and hopefully problem solve along the way and get your client the best result at the end of the day.
Now, what's the first thing that you do, Kristen, when we're talking about a lawsuit? And we're going to talk about lawsuits in civil lawsuits, civil cases, which are cases for money damages to be recovered or for injunctions to be issued or perhaps for the dissolution of a marriage or the probating of a will. But we're not going to talk about criminal cases.
That's true, civil as opposed to criminal. And when you're going to start a civil lawsuit or when you're thinking about whether you have a claim that can arise to a lawsuit, you need to do a number of things. You need to gather the facts that support what you believe is the dispute. As a lawyer, you want to talk with the client. You want to meet with the client. You want to review documents. You really want to get a good understanding of what is the problem here. What is it that you claim? How were you wronged? What did the other person do? Who is the other person? Who's the other organization? And really figure out what all the nuts and bolts are of the situation.
Now, when you're getting going on that process, how important is it to test and challenge your client as they're telling you what their story is, what the case is all about as far as their understanding goes?
That's a really important part of the process, Tom. And the reason being is that the lawyer has, extra specialized knowledge about what the law is to support the claims and that may apply to the facts in that case. And although clients may often think that something that happened to them gives rise to a legal claim, the lawyer really needs to challenge the client and drill down the details to understand if what the client thinks is a legal dispute or might give rise to a complaint actually does. So they can work on that process together.
Is part of the process finding out, does this case, number one, have merit, and can I convince a judge, jury, that this is a viable claim and I can get a favorable judgment for my client? I'm sure that's a big part of it up front. Can I win this thing?
Absolutely. And, you know, if lawyers could predict 100% of the time whether the client could win, I think we'd all have a lot more clients. That would be
some sort of reasonable judgment. I think we have a case.
Exactly. It starts out with the I think we have a case and then the analysis of do we want to bring this case forward. And that analysis of whether or not you have a case and how strong the case is continues to happen throughout the course of the case. There'll be multiple times when you are exchanging information with the other side where you say, uh-oh, now we learned about something we didn't know before. Does this change what we want to do here? Does this cause us to want to bring more claims? Are there additional bad acts we learned of? Or you may say, you know, this is something, client, that you didn't tell me about before, maybe that you didn't know about before. We need to reevaluate and consider how this may impact the overall case.
Well, and Kristen, I think sometimes people have the feeling, the impression, and I must confess I sometimes fall prey to this myself, that anybody can start a lawsuit at any time about anything. Is that true?
It's not true. And in fact, there are rules that prohibit lawyers and parties from bringing what are called frivolous lawsuits. There's actually a rule of civil procedure that lawyers are required to abide by, that parties are required to abide by, that are unrepresented. And it prevents people from filing lawsuits or starting lawsuits to, for example, harass the other party, or where there may be a claim that does not have a good faith basis to bring. Lawyers and parties in general are prohibited from bringing those kinds of claims. So you do need to do basic investigation, and you do need to actually have a viable legal claim, or at least an argument that this would give rise to a viable legal claim in order to proceed.
And so it's fair to say, I think, isn't it, that the law requires that there be a probable cause basis and a good faith basis, both in the facts of the case and in the law, for bringing a case before you can start one?
That's true.
And the remedy for not doing that or for not following that can be harsh.
That's true. One of the things that could happen if a party brings a case that doesn't have a good faith basis is you could be sanctioned by a court. A court could slap you with some sort of sanction that says you're going to have to pay the other side X amount of dollars because you did this in bad faith.
We have more on the way. Lawsuits 101. Kristen Huebner is in. Tom Scheuer, host of the program today. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. You can find Moss and Barnett online at moss-barnett.com. We have more on the way in a moment here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
You snooze, you lose. Did you know a statute of limitations sets a limit after which a lawsuit cannot be brought? The law disfavors stale claims, and courts can and will bar claims brought after the statute of limitations has expired.
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Our phone number on the program, as always, 651-989-9226, or toll-free 1-866-989-9226. You can text the studio as well, 81807. That's 81807, powered by Wellington Window and Door. Today, Lawsuits 101. Kristen Huebner in studio. Tom Scheuer is our host, and we have a new feature, Question of the Week. And we have some produced intro coming at some point with some effects, etc. But I think for now, Question of the Week is what we'll go with.
All right, Steve, that sounds very, very good and exciting, as a matter of fact. And Kristen did bring a question to us this week, as we're asking our guests to do now. And so we'll pose the question, and then it's a true or false, and ask folks to text in their answers, and then we'll read the answer at the end of the program. And then, so the question of the week, Kristen, is, can a lawsuit be started in Minnesota State Court without filing with the clerk of court? Can a lawsuit in state court be started without a filing with the clerk of court, true or false? And we'll come back at the end of the show and cover that one. But for now, we're going to return to getting a lawsuit started. And Kristen, what does every lawsuit start with?
Every lawsuit starts with a summons and complaint. And the complaint is really the document that tells the story about the dispute. It has the factual background that's required to establish the claims, or at least to identify the claims, and then it lists out what the legal claims are that the party is asking about. The rules require that a complainant or a person who has a dispute with another party merely state a plain and short statement of what they would like the court to do. They don't have to put in detailed allegations about what has happened. In complex business disputes, typically you will do more of that. You will include more factual detail, and there are many reasons you may do that. Some may be that you want to notify the other side that you actually have a lot of ammunition against them. You may also want to make sure that you are including enough facts so that you aren't subject to a court saying, I'm going to throw your case out because you didn't give enough detail here. So there are many reasons you may do that. But really what the complaint is a story that is told by the lawyers for the party who have the dispute.
And we might note for our listeners that the U.S. Supreme Court has recently adopted some new rules about putting together these complaints in the Equiball case, which are really throwing a monkey wrench into how we've been practicing for all of my career anyway, because the courts are now taking a look at these complaints and taking a look at the federal court level, that is, to see whether or not they make sense on their face. And if they don't, they're throwing them out.
That's true. And I think part of the motivation for that, Tom, is that there are, again, very basic rules for what must be contained in a complaint. And so I think sometimes that's taken to the extreme and just bare bones pleading is made. And the courts have taken a view of, wait a second, the other side, the defendant, really needs to understand what they're being sued for. They really need to have a right to challenge what these claims are. So we're going to require you to put in more detail. We're going to require you to really dig down and give us some more information in the beginning so that the defendant can fairly evaluate what they're up against.
Sure. And then after the complaint's filed and the other party has been served with legal process consisting, as you said, of the summons and complaint, then the defendant or defendants are required to insert or file their pleading.
Right. So what the defendant has then, and depending on which jurisdiction you're in and whether you're in state or federal court, there are different rules for the timing of the response. So some say 20 days, it may be longer in some jurisdictions. But within a certain number of days, the defendant is required to file their answer, and that's to read through the complaint, getting back to that story that was told by the plaintiff. And the defendant then says, I agree with this allegation, I disagree with that allegation, I don't know what you're talking about, frankly, with this allegation, and has to then serve that on the plaintiff to say, I disagree with your claims and I'm going to actually fight you on this.
And then from there, it's off to the races.
That's true. And what the races are that Tom referred to are, it's a process between that filing and serving of the complaint and trial. It's a process called discovery. And discovery encompasses a lot of different activities. There is written discovery that is served between the parties. There are things called depositions, which I'm sure a lot of listeners have heard of. But really what the discovery process means, it's called discovery for a reason. That is the time that the parties are able to exchange information with each other and really discover about the claims and defenses. So interrogatories, for example, are a written set of requests that you would serve on the other side to ask them questions.
All right. So the idea behind the process here is that the parties have to exchange information. That seems really quite unfair in a way, that I have to reveal my side of the case to my opponent before I actually end up in court. I mean, the reason for that, because I think that it would be much more fun and more effective if I could surprise them like they do in the movies.
And I don't disagree with you. I think that makes sense. It would be fun if we had that surprise element. But it's funny, now that the rules exist where you are required to exchange information with the other side, you don't see a lot of those surprise elements like you do in the movies. The surprise element that may have existed long ago isn't present anymore. And really now, parties have all the information about the other side's case before they get to trial. And it's the reason that you see so many cases settle on the eve of trial. And I shouldn't say it's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons is now when you're going into trial, you have a pretty good idea about what the witnesses are going to say. You know what the other side's documents are. You know what their story is. You know what the other side's defenses are. And so people analyze all of that information and decide, do I really want to put myself through a trial, or do I kind of have a good idea what the judge might do here?
Now, discovery has been a rather controversial subject because it adds so much cost to the process as well, though.
That's true. One of the things that's really added cost to the process is electronic discovery, and I think we can talk about that and get into that in a little more detail.
Right. We'll come back after the break in a few minutes, and we'll go back into talking about discovery, the deposition process, requesting documentation, electronic discovery, and the gamut of discovery rules as we're preparing our case for trial.
All right, we have more on the way. By the way, Tom, do you have that question of the week one more time?
Sure.
All right.
In Minnesota State Court, must a party file the lawsuit with the clerk of court to start the lawsuit?
All right, and that is a yes or no. You can text that to the studio, 81807. That's 81807, powered by Wellington Window and Door. Phone number on the program, as always, 651-989-9226, toll-free 1-866-989-9226. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Burnett here on News Radio 830-WCCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Burnett. Thanks so much for joining us. By the way, material on today's program available online at moss-burnett.com. Previous shows and much more. We invite you to go to their website, moss-burnett.com. Once again, it is Minnesota Law Today, Lawsuits 101. Kristen Huebner in studio. Tom Schroyer is our host.
Steve, we're going to return to our discussion of discovery here with Kristen Huebner as we look at the process from an overall point of view of how a lawsuit starts until it gets to the trial stage. And Kristen, I must say that one of the areas that you certainly excel at is in the taking of depositions. And so we hear many, many compliments about your work in that area. So congratulations and good for you. And maybe just tell us here briefly, do you like taking depositions?
I do. And thank you, Tom, for that. I really do enjoy the deposition process. I feel that in many ways, especially because we have so few trials nowadays, because so many cases settle, in many ways the deposition is the culmination of the case. It can be the pinnacle of the case in many circumstances. And the process of a deposition, maybe I should back up and say what a deposition is.
Yes, let's do that.
A deposition is a process by which you get to ask a witness, who's called the deponent, questions under oath. They have to answer the questions under oath. They swear an oath at the beginning of the deposition.
Is that the same oath that is given by the clerk in the courtroom when there is actually a trial being taken?
It is. It is.
And so does it have the same requirement of truthfulness as against being indicted later for perjury?
It does. In fact, it's as if you are in the courtroom in front of the judge. The difference is you're doing this typically in a conference room, typically at a law firm, or it could be at any other location. But the point is you are under oath as if you are before the judge and as if you are testifying at trial. So you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. And then the lawyer begins to ask you questions, and it can be a long day. I think I have yet to find one person that I've talked to that says they enjoy being deposed. Most people don't like it, and there's reasons for that. It is an uncomfortable process many times. The witness is sitting there having to answer questions that a lawyer is asking. Witnesses are often concerned, am I going to say the wrong thing? What if I don't know the answer to the question? What if I don't understand the question? And so it's important for lawyers when they are representing clients who are going to be deposed that they work on easing the client's concern about those issues so that they don't have as much trepidation going into the deposition.
Well, and conversely, the lawyer asking the questions wants to make it as much of a stress test as possible to, as it were, break through and get the opposing party's witnesses or even the opposing party to make admissions that will destroy or really greatly impair their lawsuits.
Absolutely. One of the things that I do before depositions is to go through very carefully all the documents in the case and figure out how can I set up my questions so that they require almost a certain answer at a point. If you answer yes, yes, and yes to three questions in a row, well, then when you get to your fourth question, the answer has to be yes. So figuring out the art of how to get to that fourth yes is often a really fun part of the process and something that does take a lot of time.
There are specific rules in a trial, I'm sure. The judge is overseeing it. What about in a deposition? Are there rules of what you can ask, how you can ask it? Can you badger someone who's being deposed? All those sorts of things you see on TV or in the movies in a court of law. What can you do in a deposition? What can't you do?
You know, really, many times in a deposition, anything goes. For the deponent, though, that's why it's important for them to have a lawyer there protecting them. So if the lawyer who's examining and asking them questions goes overboard by either repetitively asking the same question over and over in an effort to get a different answer, or asking about something that under the context of the case may be a matter of a confidential nature that's protected by some sort of confidential document, those kinds of things are off limits. But typically, you can ask about anything that's relevant to the case. So things that have nothing to do with the case are considered not proper topics of the deposition. And there are times when the disputes in a deposition about what the lawyer is asking get heated enough where you may even call the judge on the phone during the middle of the day. And I have heard that judges do not like receiving those calls, but they get them sometimes nonetheless.
One of the things I like to do in that context, too, Steve, when the opposing counsel is being a little bit obstreperous and over the top, is to bring in a video camera and take a picture of them in action, because it's funny how when people know they're being captured for all eternity, they'll settle down pretty fast.
Now, is that something you can negotiate where another attorney is, well, wait a minute, look. Is that okay to just bring in the video camera? Here's how we're going to do it.
All right. Either party can bring in a video camera and videotape the proceedings under the court's rules. So that's a very effective way. It's also a good way to pin down the witness, I think, because, again, to the same point, a lot of folks will actually be more forthcoming when they're testifying and not dance around the question quite as much.
That's true. And just to add to that, Steve, although you can use a video system to videotape the deposition, you do have to give the other side notice that you're going to do that. So when you send the notice saying, I'm going to take your deposition on this date, you have to tell them, I'm, by the way, going to have a video recorder there. So
a deposition is, though, huge, as the rules provide, that it can be used for a lot of purposes. Number one, it can be evidence that is used in asking the court to throw out a case before trial. And number two, it can be used to actually impeach a party at trial if they are going to change their testimony when they appear in front of the judge or the jury.
That's true. One of the biggest reasons that lawyers take depositions of witnesses is so that they can nail down their testimony and understand what they're going to say under oath. If you say it under oath in the deposition, you can't have a different answer at the trial. It's that simple. You're under oath in the deposition. You're under oath at trial. So your answers have to be the same. The lawyer has an opportunity to ask questions of the deponent and then figure out exactly what they would say at a trial, which gives the lawyer information about the claims and defenses.
Kristen, I probably shouldn't say this on the air, but I once took a deposition for 7 straight days of an individual. I don't think I can get away with that anymore, can I?
I don't think you can. Fortunately, there are rules that prohibit depositions from lasting into eternity, which it probably, I would imagine, the deponent in that case thought that it might have gone.
We didn't draw a single question that I had, or objection to the effect that I had asked a question twice. So 7 days of brand new questions, that was amazing.
Wow. Well, now the rules provide that you are limited to 1 day of 7 hours with 1 witness. So if you are going to depose a person, you may start at 9 o'clock in the morning. You have to be done approximately 7-8 hours later, depending on the breaks that you take. And you typically, unless there are unusual circumstances, can't drag that over into a second day.
So there's no getting around it. Discovery is an important, but it's also an expensive undertaking. And, of course, it's not just depositions that we're talking about. There are other procedures. You mentioned them, I think, before the last news break, and those are interrogatories, document requests, electronic discovery. Maybe let's break those down. What's an interrogatory?
An interrogatory is really just a question. It's a written question. So you might have a set of written questions that you write to the other side. You serve them on the other side, which means sending them over by mail or fax or whatever form you're required to serve. And the other side is required after a certain number of days to answer your questions. Now, as you mentioned before, Tom, it seems somewhat counterintuitive to the whole trial practice. Wait, why do I have to tell you everything about my defenses or my claims? But really, that's what the discovery process requires, is it requires the parties who have a dispute to exchange information with each other.
And, of course, then we also have what's called a request for documentation to be supplied. How does that work? And I guess that gets us into electronic discovery issues, which are really growing to be quite enormous issues.
They are. There's a lot of talk about electronic discovery, or e-discovery, as it's sometimes referred to. And that's because in the discovery process, parties are allowed and often ask each other questions and say, give me your documents. In addition to answering my questions, I want your documents. I want copies of them. Well, you know, 30 years ago, that was probably a lot more confined than it is today. Today, we have a lot of email, and email are documents. So think of the emails, the number of emails that you yourself, all the listeners, send and receive in a single day. Now take a complex business dispute that may involve two or more companies, a number of different employees, and the lawyers have to work oftentimes with outside vendors to get at all of the emails that may be relevant to the case. It's an enormous undertaking.
I've often said that when I got started, the practice of making copies was just getting going 30 years ago, believe it or not, in litigation. And I always said that that made my career because it gave me so many more documents to take a look at. But now it's just grown exponentially, even beyond that, frankly, with the electronic discovery. And it's become a huge cost issue.
It has. It can be very expensive for parties to engage in electronic discovery. And now the rules require you to exchange electronic discovery when you ask and respond to document requests. So it's something that, going back to the pre-suit investigation we talked about at the beginning of the hour, it's something that parties really need to consider in moving forward with their litigation, how much electronic discovery may be out there, how many different hard drives are we going to have to look at, what are the capabilities of our electronic system. Those can be really complex and tricky issues to deal with.
And electronic discovery doesn't just mean looking at the office server or somebody's laptop or PC. It also includes things like cell phones.
Yes, I think that's something that a lot of people either haven't heard about before or don't realize, is that when you send a text message, when you send an email, when you receive a text message, an email, anything that happens on your personal device, those documents, really, because they can become documents if printed, are subject to the discovery process. And they are never deleted. They never go away. People think if they hit delete on those that they are gone and go into the receptacle of Never Never Land, and that's just not true. There are ways that you can mine that electronic data off of personal devices, off of hard drives, and parties get into sometimes really messy, expensive disputes about wanting copies of the other's hard drives and personal electronic devices.
Yeah, I think the phrase that applies is email is always having to say I'm sorry, because everybody, I'm certain everybody makes a slip up in their email at one point or another.
That's true. That's true. And sometimes, unfortunately, those mistakes that are made in email come out and end up being a really big part of a litigation matter.
We have more on the way. It is Minnesota Law, Lawsuits 101. Kristen Huebner in studio. Tom Scheuer is our host. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. Text line always open, 81807, powered by Wellington Window and Door. Phone lines as well, 651-989-9226, or toll free, 1-866-989-9226. We have one segment to go on the program. Once again, Minnesota Law continues on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Scheuer is our host. Kristen Huebner in studio. Lawsuits 101. Quick text. When did the seven-hour limit for one witness in a deposition go into effect? The text says, I was deposed for 24 hours over 3 days, 8 hours a day, during divorce proceedings.
The answer, Steve, is that the rule about the seven-hour limit came into play in about 2000. Kristen's looking at the rule book now. I don't know if she can spy it quickly, but it was sometime in this past decade. But to the witness, go ahead, Kristen.
I was just going to add that the rule is different depending on whether you're in federal or state court, or not even different, but the rule of the seven-hour limit came about earlier in federal court. So the question was about a divorce proceeding, which means it was likely in state court, and that's been more recent. That change was more recent.
Right, but we should add quickly that there are exceptions, and the judges in particularly complex cases will allow the parties to be deposed for longer, but 7 hours is the desired norm.
All right, a couple of quick calls. Paul and Proctor, you're up first. Paul, hello.
Yeah, hi. So I have a question about in terms of gathering information to maybe bring forth a lawsuit. is can a private individual without notice attend a public meeting, such as a school board meeting or a city council meeting, and videotape on their cell phone the proceedings?
You know, that's a very good question. Thank you for raising it. I'm going to say I think so, but I will tell you that I think you ought to talk to a lawyer before you do so, because they are public meetings, and so that I would presume you'd have the right to do that. Kristen, do you know the answer?
Paul, thanks again for your question. I think I agree with Tom that I think the answer is you may be able to, but you do want to be careful about not violating any wiretapping laws or other laws that exist. Sometimes that's just in tape recording conversations, but there may be laws that apply in the videotape context as well.
And there are some boundaries around invading individual private citizens' rights of privacy, and so you have to be careful about some of those contexts as well.
All right, Don in Woodbury, you're on the air. Time is limited. Hello, Don.
Hi, I've got a quick question. What do you think about the judiciousness of a president being deposed under oath about his sex life in a case brought after he's elected president?
You know, that's a very good question. Thank you for raising it. I would say this. I was surprised that the court ordered the deposition to proceed, and I was surprised, furthermore, that the lawyer didn't try to appeal that and fight that harder. But as you're alluding to, President Bill Clinton was subject to a deposition for the investigation by the special prosecutor, by the plaintiff, excuse me, in the sexual harassment case. And, of course, that led to some impeachment charges. So good question.
And getting back to the issue of what you are able to say under oath or what you do say under oath, that can result in impeachment. So there could be a deposition, such as in that case, where questions are asked, questions are answered, and anything that's answered could be used in a later proceeding against you for another reason.
And, of course, that adds a whole new level to the word impeachment.
That's true.
All right. We're going to pose our question of the hour for our listeners again, and then Kristen will give the answer. And the question again, Steve, is, in a Minnesota state court lawsuit, is a party required to first file the lawsuit with the clerk of court? True or false, Kristen?
The answer is false. You do not need to first file the lawsuit with the clerk of court in Minnesota State Court to start a lawsuit. We have here, and it's actually a pretty unique procedure. It's a procedure called what's sometimes referred to as pocket service, which means that you serve the summons and complaint, that complaint that you prepared that tells the story, you serve it on the other side. You serve it by means of a process server, but you give them that complaint, and the lawsuit starts from there. So you can have an unsupervised lawsuit, essentially, where the court is not involved at all. You exchange discovery. You go through the same normal process. The only difference, of course, is if you need relief from the court, if you need the court to do something, you don't have the court's involvement, so you can't ask them to do anything. And, of course, you can file the case at any time. So if suddenly in the middle of the discovery process, the plaintiff and defendant have a dispute that arises over, you know, you're not giving me the documents I asked for example, you can say, well, I'm going to file the case in court and I'm going to ask the judge for some relief.
Yes, and so that you can have a private party lawsuit, you can use that pocket service to stop the statute of limitations from running, and it has many salutary features.
Well, the show's gone very quickly, Kristen. Thanks so much for joining us today. Kristen Huebner, Lawsuits 101. Enjoy the day.
Thank you, Steve.
And Tom, next week, an important program.
Absolutely, Steve. Cindy Ackerman will be back talking about special needs trusts.
That is Minnesota Law, Saturdays at noon, here on News Radio 830 WCCO.